Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. By the time she turned 30, classical pianist Simona Dinnerstein had nearly given up on her dream of becoming a top concert musician. But after learning she was expecting her first child, she set out to master Johann Sebastian Bach's Goldberg Variations. A self-financed recording led to a sold-out concert at Carnegie Hall and a debut album that soared to the top of the U.S. classical charts. Her next two albums also reached number one. Simona Dinnerstein joins me in the studio to talk about her forthcoming album titled Something Almost Being Said, Music of Bach and Schubert, and her unlikely rise to the pinnacle of the classical music world. Good morning, Annie. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell me about your dream from childhood.
Well, I guess it started off right when I started having piano lessons when I was 7, and I fell in love with the instrument and felt the most at home playing it, more at home than anything else that I did. And I wanted to become a concert pianist. So in the beginning, that was very much shaped by movies and things like that, you know. And so I had this idea of what it was to be a concert pianist, which meant touring and playing in all the big concert halls and wearing gowns and that kind of thing.
Do you remember which movies those were that sort of got you?
Yeah, they were rather dark films, actually. I remember the one that made the biggest impression on me, which I must have been a young teenager when I saw, was The Red Shoes. And I always thought that I would have to choose between, you know, love and my career. And, you know, it's all very romanticized in movies. I guess another movie that I remember was The Seventh Veil.
Oh, yes.
And also A Star is Born.
So in each of those, there is a single-minded pursuit. How did your parents feel about that as you were very young?
Well, I'm the daughter of an artist. My father's a painter, so he has always been very single-minded himself. And my mother, who was a teacher, was always very supportive of him. So they were both really behind me, and they understood what I wanted to do. At the same time, I was quite good at school and interested in lots of other things. And I think my mother always wanted me to try to broaden myself and not, you know, pigeonhole myself into being a musician. I think she in particular was very concerned that I was going to have a very painful life and that I was going to experience lots of rejection and hardship, which, of course, I did.
You did.
Yeah.
And the title of your new album, Something Almost Being Said, let's hear a little of the rondo from Bach's Partita, number 2, in C minor. Of course, rather than the rondo from Bach's Partita number 2, that is the Schubert. But talk about the title of this album, Something Almost Being Said?
Well, the title comes from a wonderful poem by Philip Larkin called The Trees. And in this poem, he writes that it starts off the poem by saying, the trees are coming into leaf like something almost being said. And to me, that really evokes the feeling of this music, which feels like at any moment it could turn into speech.
Can you read that poem for us?
The whole poem?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. All right. The trees are coming into leaf like something almost being said. The recent buds relax and spread. Their greenness is a kind of grief. Is it that they are born again and we grow old? No, they die too. Their yearly trick of looking new is written down in rings of grain. Yet still the unresting castles thresh in full-grown thickness every May. Last year is dead, they seem to say. Begin afresh, afresh, afresh.
I love that. And it really inspired you.
Well, to be quite honest, I found the poem after I did the recording. But I feel that those are very linked, and it's a very musical poem. And it's very hard to describe music in words. And I think that's the point of music, that it doesn't need words. But at the same time, I felt that the music that I recorded for this album, which is the Schubert Impromptus, Opus 90, and the first two partitas by Bach, are particularly spoken pieces of music.
Let's now hear that Bach partita. A conversation.
It is definitely between the two voices, the right hand and the left hand, and it's so bubbly and it's so joyful. It just feels like at any moment somebody's going to start talking, you know? And I don't know what they would say exactly, and that's also what drew me to the line almost being said, something almost being said, because it's like it's almost speech, it's almost an idea, it's almost a feeling, but you can't quite get your hands on it.
Why do you think the music of both Bach and Schubert appeals to you so specially?
Well, I've always thought there was a relationship between those two composers. Their music is very vocal. I mean, I think that they felt most comfortable writing for the voice. And as a pianist, I always want to make the piano sing. I want the piano not to sound percussive. I want it to sound lyrical. And so the lyricism that's in their writing really, really speaks to me. And also, this music is incredibly intimate. The particular pieces that I chose for this CD of Schubert and Bach, Schubert's music tends to always be intimate, I think. Bach's music can vary in that respect. But these pieces feel like they're written to be played in a room. And I really like music like that.
And, of course, you did play in a number of rooms, did you not?
Yes. Are you talking about the film?
I'm talking about early on and the notion that it was difficult for you to gain the kind of audience you really wanted. And so you played for very small groups. You played in schools. You played in prison.
Yes, I did many concerts, and I still do play a lot of concerts in smaller spaces. I think that classical music can be very formal, and the audience can often feel very distanced from the performer. And that kind of formality is something that I like to move past and make it a warmer experience. I personally like concerts where I'm sitting there and I feel close to the performer. And so if you play in a school auditorium or you perform in a library or something like that where people feel comfortable, it just brings everybody in.
And bringing everybody in when you're playing for young children, for example, playing classical music for young children, and perhaps that might be their first introduction to classical music, you can feel the reaction of that audience, can you not?
Very much, yes. I think that children are very honest in their reaction. And so it's always interesting to play for children and to see what they respond to and what they don't respond to. I've actually found it quite fascinating that children love very avant-garde contemporary music. They always love it whenever I play something that's really crazy. And I think that they just are more open to new sounds.
Simona Dinnerstein, she's a world-renowned concert pianist whose forthcoming album is titled Something Almost Being Said. And welcome back. Simona Dinnerstein is with me. She is a classical pianist. Her latest album, titled Something Almost Being Said, Music of Bach and Schubert. Simona, you said that you always wanted to be a classical pianist. And then you finally went to study at Juilliard. What happened?
Well, I started at Juilliard after high school, and I had already met a piano teacher in London named Maria Curcio, who had been a pupil of the great Arthur Schnabel. And I had sort of fallen in love with her and wanted to study with her. But my parents thought, and they were probably right, that I should get a degree, a college degree. So I went to Juilliard. And I had also already met my not yet husband, who was in England too. So I went to Juilliard for 2 years, and then I just couldn't take it anymore.
You just dropped
And I
out.
dropped out.
What was it you couldn't take
Well, I
anymore?
couldn't take being away from my husband and from my piano teacher in London, who I had just such strong feelings for. And so I moved to London and studied with her for 3 years. And it was a really transformative experience for me. She came from a very different tradition of piano playing and of thinking about music that was from sort of a pre-war sensibility.
How would you describe that?
Well, I think that nowadays pianists are more interested in a sort of thicker sound that can really project in a big hall, like a being more forceful, more sort of arm-heavy. And her sound was very translucent. You always felt like you could hear light coming through the sound. And she also didn't make a distinction between technique, the technique of playing, and the music that you played. So it was a very organic approach to music. It was being primarily a musician, and being a pianist was just the vehicle for being a musician.
Let's hear now the Bach Partita number 1 in B-flat major from Simone Dinnerstein's new album, Something Almost Being Said. I can hear what you're talking about, the light coming through.
I'm glad you can hear that. It's very important to me that I learned so much from Maria about sound.
How do you create that notion of light coming through?
Oh, it's so complicated, but it's really about clarity and every line having clarity. You know, as a pianist, you're playing at least 2 different voices at the same time. In this particular thing that we're listening to right now, there are 3 voices, and 2 of them are played by the left hand, which is bouncing over the right hand back and forth, you know. So you want every sound to be clear, but not to be forced. And so it's a question of every note having a kind of center to the sound, a core to the sound, and yet not being too thick so that you can hear sort of the space between the notes.
How does hand position play into all that?
You know a lot about piano.
Well, I have watched my son and my daughter, but okay. Tell me about that.
Well, actually, Maria had very particular views about hand position, and I actually changed my hand position quite radically when I studied with her. I used to play before that with a very flat hand, and I used to lift my fingers very high. And she wanted me to play as if I had a small orange under my hand. So that it was very circular in a way. And she wanted my knuckles to be very high. And she had distinct ideas about the separation of every part of your hand to your wrist, to your arm, to your shoulder, to your back. And being able to differentiate which part of your body you were using to produce a sound.
And that really does change the sound.
Very much so.
That comes forward.
If you're propelling the sound from arm weight, that's going to sound very different than if you're propelling the sound from your fingers and it's being supported by your arm. So, yeah, hard to explain on
no,
the radio, I guess.
No, I don't think so. I think what you're saying makes great sense. We have a caller in Leonardtown, Maryland. I hope our phones will work. Let's go to Amy. Good morning to you.
Hello. It's nice to hear Ms. Dinnerstein. And my question is a little bit about, well, I just wondered if she would comment on her collaborative work. I've heard her CDs with Zul Bailey, the cellist, and I'm thinking that her love of the conversational style of the Bach music might also go along with her collaborative work with him, because those two voices working together are kind of like a conversation. So I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks for calling, Amy.
Well, yes, I did do a tremendous amount of chamber music playing since I was little, and very much enjoyed playing with Zoll Bailey, the cellist, and we did do a couple of recordings together. So I think that studying so much chamber music and working with other musicians is kind of a very clear way of showing a pianist that there are lots of different voices with different timbres, and working with musicians that play other instruments is always a real learning experience for me, because then when I go back to playing by myself, I can think about how that sounded. And as I said, as a pianist, I'm always playing at least two voices, and they often have different kinds of sounds, each hand or each voice. And if I think, oh, this part would be nice to sound like a cello, or this part could be like an oboe, it's great if I just played with somebody who played that instrument.
And how long did you do that?
Well, I started playing chamber music when I was about 10 or 11 years old, and Zoll and I worked together for quite a long time, over 10 years.
When and why did you turn your focus to the Goldberg Variations?
Well, I learned the Goldberg Variations in, I think it was 2001, and that was kind of a combination of preparing for a debut recital that I had in Philadelphia, and also because I was pregnant and I wanted to learn a piece of music that I felt would be a significant work to learn during my pregnancy and for my son to hear.
Ah, for your son to hear.
Yeah.
Do you think he did indeed hear it?
Oh, yes, I think so, without a doubt.
And why that particular piece?
Well, I think that's probably one of the greatest pieces of music ever written, let alone for the keyboard. And it was a piece that I never felt ready to learn before. But knowing that I was going to be a mother, I felt that I was ready. I was mature enough.
That somehow the onset of motherhood was going to create something new.
Yes, I felt that it was giving me new authority, that I felt that now that I was going to be responsible for a child and helping to shape how that child thought about the world, that it was about time that I took responsibility for my music as well.
The first recording of this you heard was Glenn Gould.
Yes, I heard his second recording of it, which he made in 1981, and I just stopped in my tracks. I never had heard anything like that before. So it was a very important moment for me, hearing that work, and then I became very interested in the piece, and I collected many recordings of it over the years.
And then how long did it take you to accomplish it?
Well, I spent my pregnancy learning it. And then it took quite a while before I felt comfortable performing it. I performed it a lot in different places, but it's a piece that really you just keep on growing with. And I'm still, you know, learning so much about it as I perform it. Last year I did a tour with it, and it just keeps on growing and changing. It's that kind of piece.
Give me a sense of how a piece like that changes for you as you go along. As you repeat the performance, Do you hear something new? Do you perceive a new rhythm? Do you feel a new insight?
Well, this is a piece of music that takes about 80 minutes to play. It's a huge architecture. And it's like this very complicated tapestry in that there are many, many voices, and they're all different patterns, and each variation is written in a particularly different kind of style. And so how you balance one variation to another can really change how you think they relate to each other, how an earlier variation relates to a later variation, where you think the summit of the piece is, you know, where the low points are. And also, being a pianist, I'm always performing it on different instruments in different halls, and playing on a different kind of piano can really change the sound of it. And sometimes that can be quite interesting, in that you play on a piano that brings out a quality in it that you just didn't hear before. So it's kind of being open to the fact that every night it will be a different experience.
Simona Dinnerstein, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's take a car in Aurora, Illinois. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, and Merry Christmas to both of you.
Merry Christmas, sir.
Appreciative of this nuanced discussion of music and how it is played. This is radio that we don't usually get, and I wanted to ask if how would Simone express the reconciliation that she's apparently had that The Red Shoes didn't offer? There was another movie, and I believe it was called The Piano, in which, as the husband in the movie put it, your wings just needed to be clipped. And I won't say on the air how he clipped her wings because it wasn't pretty.
Wasn't nice.
If you've seen the movie, you know, and
yes.
It's awful.
Yes.
And the piano ends up going into the water. But
yes.
Anyway, lots of anger associated with that and so forth. But I've known musicians where musicianship itself put a considerable strain on the marriage or attitudes towards musicianship, and I wondered if you could tell us how your experience has been different from the movies that I'm referring to.
Well, I did see The Piano, which I thought was a great film, and an incredible performance,
yes.
Too. I met my husband when I was quite young. I was 15 when we met, and so he saw me through my romanticized views. You know, in the beginning, that's kind of what I thought. I thought I had to be anguished all the time, and that is not a good recipe for a marriage. So what I realized is that I'm one person when I play and when I'm on the road and performing, and I'm another person when I'm at home and I'm married and a mother. And so when I'm at home, I try to be normal and not react to things, not be too dramatic. But when I'm performing and I'm alone and I'm on the road, I allow myself to feel an artist, to feel like an artist, and to respond to life that way.
What does that mean?
Well, I think that being a musician, especially maybe being a female musician, you have to be very sensitive. You're extremely sensitive. You can't help it. That's what makes you interpret anything, you know, and be artistic, have a reaction. But at the same time, you have to have a very tough skin and be very, very sure of yourself and believe in yourself. So it's a combination of being extremely vulnerable and extremely invulnerable, like I'm not thinking of the right word, but that is how you are as an artist. And I think that it involves having extreme ups and downs. And it's very hard to live with somebody who's like that. So, you know, you have to be on an even keel when you're at home.
But, you know, one thing that made my eyebrows go up, as you said, playing on different pianos, you have not reached that point of sensitivity where you are insisting on traveling with your own piano?
Well, I have actually sometimes traveled with a piano, and it is an incredibly expensive thing to do.
Of course.
Very few people can do that. And the other thing is that pianos are temperamental. So even if you travel with one piano, it will act up and it'll be different in a different place. And it worries me, like it'll be dropped or, you know, something will happen to it. So what I am very particular about is trying to have whatever piano I perform on be prepared by a piano technician with me during the rehearsal to suit how I play. And there are lots of things that they can do to change an instrument.
And when we come back, there is a question waiting about exactly that, how you prepare the piano. Simona Dinnerstein, short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. Learn more at constantcontact.com. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight, nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. This is NPR.
Michelle Alexander is a civil rights attorney and law professor who writes that many of the gains of the civil rights movement have been undermined by the mass incarceration of African Americans during the war on drugs. She says millions arrested for minor crimes are then branded as felons for life and denied basic rights and opportunities. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Michelle Alexander. Join us.
And in the midst of these beautiful recordings, we have a number of questions about the instrument itself. This one coming from Mike here in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Your question for Simona Dinnerstein, Mike.
Yes, and thank you, Diane, for having her on.
My pleasure.
I noticed immediately the sound that she was speaking of, that the light coming through in that playing, and it's truly a wonderful separation of music to hear that. I worked on pianos for 17 years, rebuilding old pianos, many, many old Steinways and German pianos, and I'm wondering if she notices the difference between the pre-say 1925 pianos and the ones starting in the 30s, where they started to redesign pianos for more forceful and more louder sound in the halls with a heavier action, and if she prefers those.
Well, yes, I think that there's a big difference between the different pianos, and in fact, the piano that I used for this recording is a 1903 Hamburg Steinway that was rebuilt, and I've used it for the Goldberg Variations recording as well. And it has a particularly lyrical singing sound. The sound sustains, and that's really what I find so special about this particular instrument, is that the sound sustains. A lot of pianos, they're built now to have a very big impact at the front of the note so that they project out into the hall, but then immediately they don't continue. The sound doesn't continue. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of kind of sort of harshness to it, and I think that has to do with them being kind of overly lacquered. They use lacquer on the hammers, which makes this is really not for this particular man. He knows all about this, but for the average listener, they might not realize that using lacquer on a hammer can make it a harder sound. And so I prefer pianos that aren't lacquered. And I actually just bought a piano that's from Hamburg. It's a recent piano. It's only 6 years old. But it has
another Steinway.
A Hamburg Steinway, mm-hmm. which I used for my recording that I did a year ago, Bach, A Strange Beauty. I bought that piano. And that's a very unusual instrument in that it's a new piano, but it has that lyrical singing sound of an old piano. And yet the action feels, when you're playing it, it feels like a modern instrument.
Interesting. We have a question from Ian on Facebook who says, Ms. Dinnerstein's playing seems much more delicate than most pianists I hear without losing any of the power. I'd love to ask her if she'll be able to pass on the technique she's learned from pre-war Britain to a new generation. I would hate to think this style would fade.
That's very nice of him. Well, I think it's important, and there are people that are still teaching this today. Unfortunately, my teacher, Maria, passed away a little over a year ago.
Oh, I'm
which
sorry.
Which is really sad. But,
I'm sorry.
But yes, I think it's important that the new generation of pianists are aware of different ways of approaching playing the piano.
Do you believe that at some point you might move into teaching younger students?
Yeah, I think it could happen that I would teach. I somehow don't feel like it's the right time right now. I feel like I have to make a choice in what I do, and I prefer for the time that I have to be with my family as opposed to, you know, when I'm not on the road to spend with my family. But I could see when my son is in college, maybe.
You know, the other point that you were making just before the break was working with piano technicians to prepare the pianos you use on concert tours. How do you do that? How do you prepare that piano?
Well, pianos are very complex machines, and there are two things that are going on when you play a piano. There's the voicing, which is how it sounds, like the timbre of how it sounds. And that can be adjusted in different ways, usually by adjusting the hammers and how the shape of the hammers can change the quality of the sound. And then there's also the regulation, which has to do with the touch, how it feels to play the piano. And those can be regulated by, you know, changing how close the hammers are to the strings or how heavy the actual keys are. And there are all sorts of adjustments that can be made. And so you could have one piano that's prepared by a piano technician for two different pianists, and it can sound like a completely different instrument.
Oh, my.
Yeah. It's quite interesting, but it's very labor-intensive. Obviously for the piano technician, but also for the pianist. You know, I often spend, I don't know, 4 hours, 3 or 4 hours.
Before a concert
with a piano technician, and I'll be playing, and then he'll do something, and then I'll play some more, and then, you know, we keep on talking and trying to get it to be how I want it to be.
But, you know, in a sense, the piano can be something of a living organism in that it can change depending on the change of temperature, depending on the number of people in the room, depending on the entire atmosphere. So once it's been prepared, it doesn't always stay that way.
That's true. Yes, it can change. And often the thing that's quite interesting about it is that our ear can make the touch feel different. So in other words, I can hear a sound and the sound can sound muted, say, but the touch will actually be very light. But it feels hard to play the piano because the sound is soft. And it's confusing how we hear things and how we feel things. The physical sensation is so influenced by our oral sensation.
Let's go now to John, who's in Grand Prairie, Texas. Good morning to you.
Well, good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for this program. I am, as a music historian, a performer, and a lover of music for my entire life, this is an amazing event that you've created here. I wanted to ask your guest about her impression of the F minor three-part invention of Bach, which for me has surfaced over and over again in my life as a touchstone for that music and all of the music that followed it. It seems to have the seeds of all of the Romantic period, the post-Romantics, and even into contemporary and quasi-atonal elements. To have a keyboard player of this stature able to speak to us is an extraordinary thing, and I just wanted to get her impressions of the work. Thank you.
Well, it's interesting because at the moment I'm preparing the two-part inventions for some concerts and recordings, and those are pieces of music that, you know, were in a way teaching pieces. Bach wrote them for his children to learn how to play the piano and how to play lyrically. He wrote specifically how to play cantabile. And they're quite simple pieces, as are the sinfonias, the three-part inventions. They're kind of like Bach pared down, you know? But I'm just struck by how radical the music is. It's really weird harmonies, strange syncopations. There are pieces where it's not clear to me what the meter is or what the pulse is. And I think that all of that is extremely forward-looking. I think that Bach in his time was considered very conservative, and there was much more interest in other composers like Telemann. But his music has survived and been so important to everyone after him because it really did contain the seeds of all the music that was to come.
I now want to go back to the time before your incredible success began and the frustration you must have felt playing as you did, loving the music you were playing. How did you manage to go from playing in small schools, in small libraries, in women's prisons, to the concert hall?
Well, it was a long and winding road, and I think it's hard to put it down into a sentence. But basically, I had been performing the Goldberg Variations for couple of years, I guess, 3 years, and a few friends had heard me play it who were supporters, and I decided that I wanted to record the piece, and I didn't have a very clear plan of what I would do with that recording, but I thought that I had something really important to say about the music.
How did you raise the money?
Well, this is why I mentioned those friends, because what I did was I approached three friends who I thought could financially support this project, because at that moment I didn't have any money. I didn't have a management. I didn't have a record label. And they'd all heard me play the Goldberg Variations, these friends, and so I told them I wanted to record it in the highest quality way and that I thought that it might be helpful for me in my career as well, but I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do with this recording, but I thought it was important to record it. And they all said, yes, we will help you. It was really amazing. And I managed to line up a great team, an incredible producer, that beautiful instrument that I used, and I recorded it. And then it was quite miraculous kind of what happened after that, because it sort of went viral. And I started showing just little clips of the beginning to different people. I gave them just the aria and the first five variations. And suddenly different people in the music industry really wanted to talk to me and to hear me perform it. And so then I decided I needed to play it in New York. And I found a sponsor, miraculously, who sponsored that recital at Carnegie Hall. And it was packed, and it got really great review in the Times, and it led to me being taken on by a major management company. And then a year later, Telarc decided to that they would commercially release that recording that I had made.
And it zoomed.
Yes, yeah.
To number one.
Yeah, it was pretty exciting.
Pretty exciting. And you were surprised by your success?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I still can't quite believe it. It really wasn't that long ago. I mean, it happened in the CD was released August of 2007. And my life has just completely changed since
then.
How
so?
Well, I mean, I really have the career that I dreamt about when I was seven, you know. And I didn't think that that was going to happen. And I didn't even think that that existed. I didn't even know that this could exist. The things that I do now, the concerts that I play, before that, I didn't even know that there were opportunities like this. So, my world has just gone haywire.
Simona Dinnerstein, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How much are you touring? How much are you with your family?
Well, I've decided that I don't want to be on the road all the time. So I play what seems like a lot of concerts to me. I play around 50 concerts a year. There are plenty of pianists that are doing double that amount. But it's important for me to be home. So playing 50 concerts a year means that most months I'm away about half of the month, because there's traveling and all of that. So that's about what I'm doing.
I want to hear you talk about this Bach Partita number 2. Tell me about this.
This piece is, it's an incredible piece of music, but it's quite challenging to play, I have to say. It's so sparkly, and there's so much going on, and one can easily get confused. but I think that it's just so much bubbling over, and I love that aspect of it, that at the end of this very serious piece, the partita is really it's really sad and tragic and kind of full of a kind of feeling of regret going through the whole work. And then for this to be the final movement. The other thing that's interesting about it is that it's so kind of sparkling and uplifting, but it's in a minor key. And I find that quite intriguing, because usually we think of minor keys as being, you know, more down, more sort of depressing, and this is certainly not that. Thank you.
is Simona Dinnerstein playing on a 1903 Humburg Steinway for her newest album, Something Almost Being Said, the music of Bach and Schubert. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
A true pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from